Welcome back. I hope everyone is all rested up and hyped to get back into the swing of things after the bye week. Thanks for joining us on the DenverBroncos.com podcast. It was a short little vacation weekend for us, with many players heading home to see family or to visit their alma maters. And even for us on the staff, many of whom traveled to the mountains or across the country for a brief reprieve during the season. But that's behind us now, and we've all got to get back in the rhythm of things. With that in mind, back to football. Of course, there was no Broncos game to watch this weekend, so there's no Broncos game to recap. But we got a chance to watch some other games from around the league, so we can talk a little bit about some interesting stories outside of here. As a couple Carolina folks, we've been around Steve Smith Sr. for a long time, either as a spectator or in Andrew's case as a reporter. I think the planets really aligned for this game. I don't mean to overhype it, but revenge games have kind of been overdone to this point, where a lot of times there isn't much meaning to it, or a player's not exactly hyped up for it. But with this, you kind of have this perfect storm. You've got a loyal player who's not afraid to speak his mind, who also wears his emotions on his sleeve during games. And then you have this reportedly unceremonious split. And then you have a game pitting the two against each other just months after it all went down. Blood still a little bit boiling, emotions a little bit high there. And you definitely don't want to do that with a player like Steve Smith. And so he goes out, blammo, Smitty goes ham, 122 yards, 2 touchdowns, all in the first half. And then the Ravens kind of coast on the second half with the Panthers not playing up to the same level they had in the first two games. Now, Mace, knowing what you know about Smith and covering him for a little while, and the Panthers, what did you think about his personality, about how it can play into his game, and how it played into that game specifically?
Well, I've never covered a guy who, when he walked through the doors of the locker room, the facility, or walked onto the field, had as much intensity and took things as personally as Steve Smith. But, you know, it's interesting because he's got the reputation for being a loose cannon. We know about the incidents where he punched teammates once in a meeting room and then once actually on the field at training camp back in 08 when he decked Ken Lucas on the sideline. But, you know, when he it's interesting because when he leaves the building, you know, he's about the most boring guy you can imagine. I mean, he spends all his time with his family, with his kids. When he served a 2-game suspension at the start of the 08 season, he spent the Sundays at his kids' soccer games. There's something about him that flips a switch when he walks into the stadium, whether it's, you know, Bank of America Stadium before or now, M&T Bank Stadium where the Ravens play. And I've never seen a guy who took, you know, slights as personally and used them as motivational fuel. I mean, you know, some guys, you know, people talk bad about them and they kind of internalize it. They internalize it and they let it eat away at them. He chooses to channel it. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing how he does that. I mean, a lot of guys do that, but he takes it to a whole other level. I mean, some say there's a chip on his shoulder. I'd say it's a whole boulder on his shoulder. It's just incredible. That's what's allowed him to be the player that he's been for most of the last 14 years. So what he did on Sunday against Carolina, absolutely no surprise. And I think he's going to carry that with him. What was a surprise to even me was him making that call and appearance on the sports radio station in Charlotte on Wednesday. Reportedly, he called them. They didn't call him. He just called up unsolicited to go off on his rant against Ron Rivera and Dave Gettleman, the Panthers' GM. Even knowing what kind of fire he has and how personally he takes things, that surprised me. I thought that he would have gotten past that game and let it go because he'd had some comments about, you know, hey, someday I'm going to retire as a Panther and, you know, Charlotte's my home and, you know, and things are going to heal. But I'll tell you, with what he said on the radio Wednesday, I think he kind of napalmed that bridge a little bit. And, you know, when he does retire, if Rivera and Dave Gettleman are there, I don't know if they're going to be on board with giving him that one-day contract that you see given to a lot of players who go somewhere else and then come back, and quote-unquote retire as a player, something like what we saw with Brian Dawkins going back to Philadelphia for a day. I don't know they're going to be open to even making that conciliatory step just because of the things he said. It was a little bit of a surprise to me, that part.
As far as revenge games go, does that one stand out? Or what other ones have you seen in the past that have lived up to the hype like that?
Well, remember Brett Favre going back to Green Bay in 09 when he was with the Vikings because he didn't make it there in 08 when he was with the New York Jets. That's a game that stands out. I wouldn't call it revenge, but Brian Dawkins, who I mentioned earlier, when he went back to Philadelphia in 09, that was an emotional return for him. I mean, he was introduced and got a standing ovation. The same thing happened for John Lynch when he went back to Tampa Bay in 04 after he'd signed with the Broncos. And that was fairly emotional. The interesting thing about that is I think he had his chance on the quote-unquote revenge hit, but he was afraid of getting a penalty. So he kind of pulled up and tagged Michael Clayton, their wide receiver, instead of giving that kind of big hit that he was known for. The problem was when he gave the tag, Clayton was on the ground but had already gotten his knee off the ground, and the tag, of course, did nothing because Clayton's knees were off the ground, and he went to the end zone and scored. And Lynch was mic'd up for that game, and there's NFL Films clip of him complaining about the fact that I can't really make that hit because you're going to penalize me, but at the same time, I'm tagging the guy and he's down. It was kind of frustrating for him. But as far as revenge games, I mean, certainly the Favre game stands out. You definitely wouldn't call Peyton Manning going back to Indianapolis last year revenge in any way. I mean, that's in the kind of with the Dawkins and the Lynch games. It's there's more positive emotions, and if anything, you're overcome by the reception that you feel. I think maybe the venue had something to do with it. He wasn't going back to Carolina. The game was in Baltimore, but I think also Steve Smith's personality that we've discussed. I think that factors into it. He's a pretty unique guy. Me, I liked covering him because he was honest to a fault, and he'll say some outrageous stuff. And so, if you're a reporter, I mean, it's just gold. It's just gold on your notepad. But I like the fact that he was with me. He was always honest and sincere, even if it wasn't what you wanted to hear. And being someone who occasionally takes things personally, I relate a little bit to him, although I've never punched a teammate before.
I'll definitely keep my eyes out for that. Looking elsewhere around the league, we had a couple rookie quarterbacks sliding into their starting roles like many thought they would. You had Blake Bortles in Jacksonville and Teddy Bridgewater in Minnesota. Did you like what you saw from them? How bright are their futures?
I really like what I saw from Bridgewater. I had a chance to watch most of that game on Sunday. Just liked his decision making. I mean, he's got a good sense of when to tuck it and run, and when to throw. Just a very dynamic element for that offense. That really, with Adrian Peterson being suspended after the child abuse charges, that's an offense that need a spark between him and also a rookie that I really liked coming out, Jerick McKinnon, a converted quarterback turned running back that had some big gains. I thought that offense got the spark that it needed, albeit against a Falcons defense that has been very shaky at times. I think what you're going to see a lot more of against Bridgewater, you're going to see teams keeping a spy on him because his legs are such a threat. I want to see him get the ball into some narrow windows like you have to do in the pros, but as far as debuts go, I don't think you could ask for anything more. Blake Bortles, similar positives in how he galvanized that offense early. I think the one thing that concerns me that isn't so much the case with Bridgewater, Bridgewater's got a decent offensive line in front of him in Minnesota. Bortles has one of the worst offensive lines in front of him in Jacksonville. And the fear with him this year is that being behind that line, that his internal clock starts to malfunction a bit in terms of trying to feel the pass rush, and maybe you're delivering the ball too soon, or maybe you're deciding to run when instead you should stay in and throw. My concern for Bortles this year behind that line is that he develops bad habits that he's not able to get out of. And we've seen that from some guys over the years. I recall, David Carr in Houston in 02. They thought they had it planned well by drafting Tony Boselli in the expansion draft, but Boselli never played it down for them because he was hurt. So the grand plan to have a strong offensive line with a strong blindside protector for Carr in 2002 never materialized. And because of that, he was under siege most of his first few years. And that really messed him up in a way that he was never able to fully recover from. And then he ended up, you know, winding down his career as a backup. So that's the concern for me with Bortles, is that he's playing behind that line. He ends up, you know, doing some things just to try and survive and not get injured on a hit, and that he falls into some bad habits. That's something the Jaguars are going to have to focus on going forward.
And last up, a month from Thursday is the Broncos game against the Patriots in Foxborough. It's always been a big matchup, Manning and Brady, for much of the last decade. But on Monday night, they took quite a shellacking against the Chiefs. What's going on with them?
Well, it starts with the offensive line. It was struggling even before they traded Logan Mankins. And granted, Mankins did not have a good season last year for the Patriots, but he was that experienced leader, could kind of get things back on track. I don't see the leadership on the Patriots offensive line. I don't see the cohesion there. They're slow to react to blitzes, you know, whether they come from the outside or they're coming up the A gap. They just don't they don't seem to know when they're coming. And Brady's kind of anticipating that, and the ball is coming out too soon, you know, it's relative to where the receivers are going, and it's leading to some turnovers. The other thing with Brady, if you look over the last couple of years, actually I would say even more, maybe even going back to 2011, you know, there's appears to be a gradual decline in arm strength. You know, he's not completing as many of those 20-yard outs as he was able to. He's not taking as many deep shots as he used to, and that's really affecting the offense. Now, when they had Aaron Hernandez and Rob Gronkowski both healthy and available, that masked any decline in arm strength that Brady had, because you had basically, the way I would say to Broncos fans is, for a time, they had two Julius Thomases out there. And basically, you could have breakfast, lunch, and dinner going down the seam or on quick outs, on 10-yard posts, and, you know, that was able to drive their offense to where they didn't really need that deep threat. But now you only have Gronkowski, and he's battled injuries the last couple of years, and, you know, not having those security blankets is really hindering that offense. They're going to have to rethink what they do offensively going forward, you know, because there's still things Brady can obviously do well, but with Gronkowski's health a concern and him not being what he used to be without Wes Welker, yes, that has an impact as well. That really helped a quarterback who was getting older and, you know, didn't necessarily have the same arm strength. Having Welker on the drags and crosses and the quick outs, you know, that, you know, sustain that offense, and they haven't quite been able to replace that with Edelman and Amendola on a consistent basis. They're going to have to rethink some things in that offense to try and compensate. And I don't know that they are going to have the answers there to be an elite offense. Certainly, the last couple of weeks, the results are poor, and I don't think it's going to get much better Sunday night against a very tough Bengals team. I mean, you know, Kansas City has a good front seven. The Bengals have an outstanding front seven. And if the offensive line doesn't give Brady more time to throw, and if he's not able to get anything downfield, they're going to have problems. So this may get worse for them before it gets better.
Speaking of the Chiefs, let's take this time to break down the division's play this week. Though the Broncos had the week off, the rest of the AFC was busy. Once again, Oakland was the lone loser in the division this week, taking their ineptitude worldwide with a visit to London. On the flip side, Kansas City trounced New England in primetime Monday night, and San Diego took care of business against Jacksonville. I'm joined by our correspondents, Lauren Judici and David Deschant, to go over what happened. Starting with Oakland, things got a bit ugly in London. They scored the first and last points of the game, but nothing in between, losing 38-14 to the Dolphins. Derek Carr left with a high ankle sprain and an MCL sprain, and then they fired head coach Dennis Allen late Monday night. Lauren, what the heck happened out there?
Well, let's just say I take back what I said last week about the Raiders' impressive performance against the Patriots. That game in London wasn't pretty. Yeah, like you said, the Raiders got the first and last scores of the game, but really couldn't produce anything else. Things started out well for the Raiders, and Carr completed a 30-yard pass to James Jones on the first play of scrimmage, and they finished the drive with a 3-yard touchdown pass. So it was looking pretty good, but Then Ryan Tannehill took control, and Oakland began the game without linebackers Nick Roach and Cio Moore, who were both inactive. And because of their absence, Tannehill and his receivers really took advantage of the short pass and yards after catch. A touchdown from Mike Wallace, two from Lamar Miller, and Deion Sims kept piling it up on the Raiders. And a fumble return for a touchdown really capped off the scoring for the Dolphins in the fourth quarter. Derek Carr finished the game 16 of 25 for 146 yards with one touchdown and one interception, but Tannehill was really the star of the game. His status as the starter was somewhat questioned during the week, and he really dominated the Raiders, going 23 of 31 for 278 yards and two touchdowns and one pick. You know, even though Maurice Jones-Drew was back after missing the last two games of the hand injury, he only had 1 yard on two carries in the game, and obviously, that can be attributed for them wanting to ease him into the game. And James Jones finished the day with 6 receptions for 83 yards. You know, and it's just, you know, you can't really expect too much out of Derek Carr. He doesn't really have the weapons that a lot of other quarterbacks have. And a lot of pressure is falling on him. You know, the Raiders can only accumulate 53 yards on the ground. And even with Jones-Drew back, and his receivers haven't really been that consistent. Andre Holmes was targeted 12 times and only had 5 receptions for 74 yards. And the Raiders' defense couldn't really get anything going either. With Roach and Morgan, that's a big blow, but 38 points to the Dolphins, you can't do that, and you can't expect to win with that going. So luckily for the Raiders and Carr, they have their bye week this week, so they'll have some time to get used to having Tony Sparano as their interim head coach. And Carr said he expects to start against the Chargers during their next games, but you know, things won't get much easier with as they go and face the Chargers at home.
An injury to your young quarterback, 4 turnovers, and sacks not only to the quarterback, but then sacking your own head coach. Are things in a bit of a free fall for Oakland?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can't really blame Dennis Allen for all of this. Obviously, the personnel really isn't there, and it's rough out there in Oakland right now. 0-4, and I mean, things don't get much easier taking on the Chargers, and you can't blame Carr for everything that's happened there. And I do see potential in him, but you know, those weapons aren't there and aren't producing. So things don't look good in Oakland right now.
Thank you, Warren. Definitely not a good situation out there in the Bay as the Raiders sit without a win still. Turning our attention to the Chargers, you thought they might get an easy game at home against the winless Jaguars, but the first half was a bit contentious with Jacksonville leading 14-10 before an Eddie Royal touchdown reception with a minute to go in the half. The second half was a different story, and San Diego romped to a 19-point win. David, what's the story there?
Yeah, you know, the final score says that we got, you know, a pretty big blowout, which we've seen from teams playing Jacksonville so far this year. But the first half was pretty close for a little while. The Jaguars were leading in the second quarter. They had 2 long touchdown drives. Blake Bortles threw a touchdown pass, which was nice. They were up 14-10. And then the Chargers scored late in the half, like you said. Eddie Royal, it was his second touchdown of the day for the second week in a row. He's done that now. And then they scored on their first possession in the third quarter as well to really build that lead, and then kind of just pulled away from there. Phillip Rivers was efficient as usual. I think he had 377 yards, 3 touchdowns, excellent quarterback rating. This is what we're used to seeing from him. Even though Danny Woodhead is out and hurt, a big part of their passing game, it doesn't seem like it's influencing Rivers at all. He's hitting the open man, finding him, and they're really being productive despite also having injuries on the offensive line. So it's been pretty impressive from Phillip Rivers so far. Keenan Allen also had a nice bounce-back game after a slow start this year. He had 10 catches for 135 yards. So they're really clicking on all cylinders on offense right now, and it showed in the win.
One of the big things that people were paying attention to this game for was Blake Bortles making his first start for Jacksonville. He completed 29 of his 37 passes, but he had 2 picks to his 1 touchdown. What did you make of the Chargers' defensive game against him?
You know, the Chargers' defense, they gave up a couple drives early. Bortles was, you know, efficient moving the ball. There were a lot of safe throws, short throws, yards after catch type of plays. But then in the second half, you know, they really kind of took advantage of the rookie, Brandon Flowers, who the Chargers signed from the Chiefs this past offseason. He kind of broke on the ball a little quickly when Bortles was staring down a receiver, snagged the pick, and then Eric Weddle did the same thing late in the game to get the second interception of Bortles. Overall, Bortles was pretty impressive, but the Chargers' defense really buckled down on him in the second half and limited the Jaguars' offense. Some other takeaways from this game, I mentioned the offensive line injuries. Chargers are down to Doug Ligursky, their third center of the year due to injuries, which is not the best. We saw him take a questionable false start penalty. He picked up the ball as if he intended to snap it and then casually tried to set it back down with no one noticing. Obviously, they noticed there was a flag there. We'll see how that goes moving forward, even though Phillip Rivers has been great without great protection so far. Another takeaway, a little bit worrisome for the Chargers, was their red zone offense in this game. They actually didn't score a touchdown from in the red zone. They scored three long touchdowns, but in their four times in the red zone, they kicked field goals all four times. So far this year, they've only scored touchdowns on 42% of their red zone possessions. That's 24th in the league. Not what you'd expect from this good of an offense and an offense that's great on third down. So it'll be interesting to see if that's just a small trend right now that'll fade away or if that'll continue as the season goes along. For now, they're 3-1, top of the AFC West, a half game ahead of the Broncos. They don't have the toughest slate coming up. They have the Jets, then the Raiders, and then the Chiefs before they play the Broncos on Thursday night in Week 8. Be interesting to see what those teams' records are when that game is on the horizon.
Thank you, David. And last but not least, the Chiefs were quite impressive in their win at home over New England in Monday Night Football. It was all Kansas City in the first half. Jamaal Charles had a touchdown run to start off in the first quarter. Then he caught a touchdown pass from Alex Smith in the second quarter. And after another field goal, the Chiefs took a 17-0 lead into the halftime break. It wasn't until towards the end of the third quarter that the Patriots even scored in this game. And that touchdown put them at 27-7. Mays talked a little about the offensive woes of the Patriots. Tom Brady completing 14 of 23 attempts with two interceptions. They had zero continuity and couldn't convert third downs. But they also were in for a world of hurt on defense. The Chiefs found their rhythm with ease, especially in the ground game with Jamaal Charles back. But his return was just a piece of the puzzle. Backup running back Nile Davis had 107 rushing yards to Charles' 92, and each averaged over 5 yards per carry. Alex Smith made few errors and didn't turn the ball over whatsoever, with 3 touchdowns and no picks. Tight end Travis Kelce and Charles were the main beneficiaries, with Kelce nabbing 93 yards receiving and a touchdown, and Charles taking 2 passes into the end zone. The defense did well in its own right, getting pressure on Brady and covering well. One of Brady's interceptions was returned for a touchdown, too. Through and through, a dominant performance by the Chiefs every way you can look at it. They held time of possession by about 13 minutes, started with the ball on average at their own 35-yard line, compared to the Patriots, who averaged possession starting at their own 16. All things considered, the Chiefs have come out okay after the first 4 weeks, especially when you take into account the injuries they've suffered. Had they not lost their opener to the Titans, they'd have an impressive early slate outside of the last-minute loss to Denver. This Sunday, they'll try to stretch their winning streak to 3 as they take on the 49ers on the road. Now let's look back to our focus, which is, naturally, the Broncos. They welcome in the undefeated 3-0 Cardinals, also coming off a bye, and they hope to make that an uncomfortable reception for Arizona. Historically, the Broncos have been very good against the Cardinals with only one loss in 9 games in interconference play, but the last matchup was in 2010, and these are two completely different teams. One of the big changes in the Cardinals in that time has been their defense. They're 4th in rushing defense with about 71 yards allowed on the ground per game. Is their best defensive strength in forcing teams to be one-dimensional on offense?
Okay, it's not just forcing them to be one-dimensional, it's also taking that one dimension and limiting, you know, what you can do with it, really. You look at their top two cornerbacks, Patrick Peterson and Antonio Cromartie, both off to good starts. Neither one of them is allowed to play longer than 17 yards all year. Now, teams, you know, can make big plays, but you're counting on making that against the nickel corner, and you're counting on making that against the safeties. So in this game, I think the key is going to be what the Broncos tight ends do and what kind of plays they can make happen down the middle. You know, we've talked about the running game. We've written about it on the website. I don't know if that's going to get fixed this week against a front seven like this one that is able to bring penetration from all angles. It's a front seven that causes a lot of problems. You know, even without Darnell Dockett, they've missed him. But Calais Campbell, who is a local native coming back home to Denver, product of South High School, he's been arguably their defensive MVP. And it's interesting to watch how they use him based on the situation. You'll see, you know, he's a 3-4 defensive end. You know, on sometimes they'll move him inside, they'll move him outside. He may at some point in the game be one-on-one against every Broncos offensive lineman. And so the first thing you've got to do when you're setting up, if you've got to know where Calais Campbell is, and maybe, you know, try to get to guide your play, especially on the run away from him. But this is a pretty tough defense to try to get the running game going against. You know, Monte Ball on Monday talked about, you know, changing some of the things that the Broncos running game does, trying to play more to their strengths. But you know, that being said, playing to their strengths may not result in anything better, at least in this game, because of the disruption that Arizona can get from its front seven against the run.
For the Cardinals offense, there's a little bit of uncertainty behind center. Things are a bit up in the air due to some nerve problems in Carson Palmer's shoulder. He was originally thought to be coming back this week, but he suffered a little bit of a setback on Wednesday and had to see a specialist. Their backup, Drew Stanton, has been solid with 2 touchdowns and no interceptions so far. But what is it that Stanton brings in Palmer's absence?
Well, they're very similar quarterbacks. In fact, really, that's one of the reasons why Stanton was kind of an ideal backup to Carson Palmer, is that you're basically able to keep the offense the exact same, maybe a little bit more foot speed than Carson Palmer, but not something to where all of a sudden you're going to call for a lot of bootlegs and rollouts, or that you're going to if you're the defense, you're going to have to spy on Drew Stanton. None of that really. What works for Stanton is you know, being able to go 3 deep in quality targets with with Larry Fitzgerald and Floyd and of course John Brown, the rookie who's been working in the slot, and he provides some speed and explosion. Floyd's been very effective getting downfield. I mean, you saw he had that big play on the post route against San Diego back in week 1. He stretches the defense. And Fitzgerald, you know, he's lost a step in terms of his speed, but he's still capable of winning any jump ball. Having targets like that really helps, especially in terms of Floyd and Fitzgerald, because you don't, you know, those are guys that can still make plays in tight coverage. They don't need to have a lot of separation to get things going. So, you know, so it makes it a little easier on Drew Stanton. I think that trust level allows him to you know, it may be construed as forcing some throws in there, but when you have receivers of those of the quality of Floyd and Fitzgerald, it's not forcing it. It's a pretty good shot when he goes downfield, and that's of course stretches a defense that opens things up underneath. So, you know, Stanton is doing a good job of using the weapons at his disposal, and you know, like you mentioned, no interceptions. He's playing no mistake ball, and really, with the Cardinals, you talk about the quality of their defense. Andre Ellington's off to a pretty good start in the running game. What you're asking from the quarterback is be able to take some shots downfield and not make mistakes. That's what they've got now, Drew Stanton. That's why they're 3-0.
A player who can make things more difficult for Arizona's offense will be Danny Trevathan, who is expected to make his regular season debut after a tibia fracture sidelined the Broncos' 2013 leading tackler during this preseason. Can his play kind of tie together the entire defense with his intensity and energy?
Not just his intensity and energy, but the way he can cover everything sideline to sideline, and the way he reads plays as they develop better than almost anyone in the league at his position. That's to me what stands out. I watch him, and he obviously studies the game very well, because his anticipation is second to none, and that allows him to be in position to make plays. And of course, that combined with just his natural speed and athleticism that allows him to cover a lot of ground, it's going to free up the defense to do so many more things. I mean, really, you know, I think you're going to see more blitzes from the Broncos, you know, because Trevathan can cover so much ground. Maybe, you know, whether it's a nickel situation where you've got Trevathan and Brandon Marshall working together, maybe you're free to send Brandon Marshall, you know, up the A-gap behind the defensive tackles and get some pressure on Drew Stanton right away. It will open up so much more for the defense. The other thing to consider as well, you know, Trevathan, he's coming back. He was the Iron Man last year. You know, he led the Broncos in snaps played. I mean, you really couldn't envision that defense without Trevathan out there. He just, you know, he was like a piece of steel in there. And you know, he's coming off the leg injury. They can kind of they can ease him back into work because of what Marshall and Nate Irving did, you know, particularly their work in the nickel. Both of them prove that they have some coverage ability. They can cover some ground. So they can kind of limit – if they want to limit Trevathan to 65-70% of the snaps on Sunday, they can do that, knowing they've got some quality in reserve. And then going forward, you know, now if Trevathan says he wants a breather or the coaches want to, you know, give him a little bit of rest, they can do that because they can use Marshall and Irving together when they're in nickel and they can get some quality results. So, you know, Trevathan is going to certainly help transform the Broncos defense. But after the last 3 weeks of Brandon Marshall and after seeing Nate Irving play almost every down as the Mike linebacker and also one of the two linebackers in the nickel, you're pretty confident that the Broncos have the kind of depth there that they did not have in previous years.
Like Terrence Knighton was saying in the locker room Wednesday, he kind of views this defense as one that has 15 to 16 starters. With all the experience that they've had in the first few games, they're able to swap people out pretty seamlessly, it seems like. For the Broncos, on offense and defense, what is it you want to see them improve upon in either of those sides of the ball?
Well, you start with the running game, and like I said earlier, it's going to be difficult because of what the Cardinals bring in terms of run defense. What you want to see are fewer plays where the defender is meeting the ball carrier behind the line of scrimmage. That was a big problem. It happened on 11 of 19 run plays in Seattle. You know, ideally, you want to see. You know, the ball carrier get to the line of scrimmage or beyond before being hit, you know, ideally 75-80% of the time. If the Broncos do that, even if they don't have a high per carry average, even if it's getting the line of scrimmage and falling forward for a yard or two, if they can minimize those, I think that will show the kind of progress they want to see from the running game coming out of the work they did over the bye. Defensively, you're going to get Trevathan back. Obviously, that's going to help. You want to limit the explosive plays. And they did a good job of that against Seattle, really only, you know, one big downfield play that cost them. That was the touchdown scored in the second quarter. You want to prevent that, and obviously that's the threat that the Cardinals pose. If you can prevent those explosive passes down the field, those back shoulder plays, then you're going to win this game. Those are the two areas that I think you want to see the Broncos concentrate on and succeed. And if they manage to do those, I think they're going to win.
Now, this is far from a focus for the team this weekend, but this game carries a good chance for two big Broncos players to hit momentous milestones. For Peyton Manning, that's hitting 500 career passing touchdowns, which puts him in a company of two, him and Brett Favre. And then you also have Wes Welker, who is just three receptions away from passing Rod Smith for most catches in the NFL as an undrafted player. What do these benchmarks say about either of these two players?
Well, with Manning, it just says, I think, what we all know, that he's arguably the best quarterback who's ever come through this game. I mean, you know, he's going to hit 500. The league record for touchdown passes is not far behind. I mean, at his current pace, I mean, he may well surpass Brett Favre's record before the end of the month. And that's, you know, these things just crystallize, you know, for all time, or at least until the standards are broken, what we know about Peyton Manning's proficiency, about his ability, about how he's helped change the game of quarterback. Because, you know, if he plays another couple of years, you know, the touchdown record's only going to be the first to fall. You're going to see yardage fall. You're going to see completions fall. If he continues at this pace that he's been on since he came to Denver, then he could own every major career standard for quarterbacks in a short time. Welker, you know, it means a lot. It's certainly a credit to him. It's a credit to his persistence because he did bounce around some. Obviously, you know, he started with San Diego, and San Diego let him go as a rookie, and then Miami picked him up, and Miami did not have the foresight to retain him when he was a restricted free agent, let him go to New England. So, you know, whereas Rod Smith, I think it's a credit not only to him but also the Broncos for recognizing the talent they had and sticking with him and letting him develop. I think Wes Welker is more of an individual accomplishment for him. But certainly, it's quite meaningful and quite profound, and it's another line on a pretty sterling resume that continues to expand. I mean, when Wes Welker is done with football, you know, the Hall of Fame case for him is going to be A, that he has this record for undrafted guys that we're talking about, but B, and most importantly, that he revolutionized what the slot receiver can be. He's one of, you know, when you look at how the game has evolved, and particularly in the last 10 to 15 years, when you talk about the, you know, the emergence of the slot receiver as a threat, as a guy who can power the offense, the first guy you mentioned is Wes Welker. To me, his Hall of Fame case down the line rests upon the fact that he transformed what the slot receiver could do for an offense. He raised the bar, and everyone's still trying to pursue what Wes Welker did as a slot receiver. So it's another line on the resume that's looking very good for eventual Canton induction, in my opinion.
Thank you, Mace. The game is at 2:05 Mountain Time at home in Denver, and this one looks like a big matchup between top teams in each conference. Two great teams trying to prove their strength in the league, and with the chance of history being made, you won't want to miss this one. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Ben Swanson for DenverBroncos.com.